This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this week's episode, we hear an interview with Brian Becker, a national leader of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, conducted by Ernesto Aguilar. It's on the topic of winning reforms while fighting for revolutionary change. This is part of a series of talks that will be accessible on our new Liberation School, which you can find at liberationschool.org.
This seems like one of these debates that is ongoing within Marxist currents, revolution versus reform. It's a debate that, long as I can remember, it seems like it's been happening in various levels of spiritedness. How do we define revolution?
Well, there's different kinds of revolutions. There's the social revolution, which changes the property relations in society, changes a mode of production. And there's also political revolutions, whereby one group of political parties or political organizations lose power to another group without necessarily changing the social or property relations within a given society. Take the American Revolution, for instance. It is called the American Revolution. It was a revolution against a form of government whereby King George and the British monarchy ruled over the 13 colonies, and they had a declaration of independence and a revolutionary war that lasted from 1776 to 1783. And a revolution took place, meaning the old government was displaced and a new government was created. But if you look into society itself, the social relations, those relations were basically undisturbed, even though the British crown was replaced first by the Articles of Confederation and then a constitutional republican form of government. The slaves were still the slaves. The slave owners were still slave owners. In other words, the basic essence of property relations remained the same. So we would characterize the American Revolution as a political revolution, but not a social revolution. There wasn't a shift or change in class relations. The means of production or the mode of production, this mode of production of slavery. In other words, the ruling class, the planter class in particular in the South, which was the dominant sector of the nascent American bourgeoisie, they derived their profits from the enslavement and slave labor of people who had been kidnapped from Africa and brought to the 13 colonies. And after they declared independence, after the new government came into power, they still had their slaves. In fact, in some ways, the political revolution in the American Revolution was partly a counter-revolution, because to the extent that the war started between the 13 colonies, the colonists, George Washington-led army, and the British crown promised enslaved people that they would become free people. And more than 100,000 African slaves, or slaves whose ancestors came from Africa, either ran away from their slave owners or attached themselves to British encampments. And at the end of the war, when the revolution succeeded, part of the terms of the agreement was that those enslaved people had to be returned to their slave owners. So the political revolution was also, at least from the point of view of enslaved people, a political counter-revolution. There was another revolution in the United States. That was the U.S. Civil War. It's not called a revolution, but in fact, that was a social revolution, because it ended once and for all, and for all time within the United States, the institution of chattel slavery, whereby some human beings could purchase and own as property other human beings, and by the virtue of using their unpaid enslaved labor, that ruling class could derive great profit. The end of the Civil War also ended the institution of slavery. It ended its legal ability to own human beings. The U.S. Constitution was altered to make that permanent. Even though racism and all sorts of white supremacy and a kind of neo-slavery developed after the defeat of the Reconstruction period in the southern states of the United States between 1865 and 1876, even though for the mass of the black population in the southern states who were returned to servitude of different types, there was not a return to formal slavery. So the Civil War was a social revolution because it ended a property relation whereby human beings were the property of other human beings. The Russian Revolution was a social revolution and a political revolution. It was the first time, the very first time, that the working class, the proletariat in the cities, and the poor peasants who made up the majority of the population in the countryside, was the first time in human history that they not only rose up. That had happened many, many times, that the peasants and poor had risen up, but they took the power. And more importantly, they held the power. And that was the first time that an oppressed class, the exploited class, was able to seize and hold state power and try to reorganize society in its interests. In other words, without the dominant interests of an exploiting class. Throughout human history, up until the time of the Russian Revolution, there had been many, many revolutions, but they had the effect of replacing one group of exploiters with another group of exploiters, one group of private property owners with another group of private property owners. In the case of the Russian Revolution, the collective working class and poor peasantry seized the power and said, we're going to get rid of exploitation altogether, and they created a new social system based on collective rather than private property. Again, a social revolution because the property relations shifted. From a private property owning system, it became public property or collective property. When we talk about revolution in the Marxist sense, we're talking really fundamentally about a change in class relations, a change in the social relations, whereby in the case of the socialist revolution, the oppressed majority that works day in and day out for the profit of a small group of exploiters, the capitalists in modern day society, that they take the power, hold the power, and reorganize society in their interest, meaning everyone has a right to a job, and everyone has a right to free health care, and everyone has a right to affordable housing, and everyone has a right to free education. In other words, the things that working people need become the priorities rather than the priority of profit by the private property owning capitalist class. That's how Marxists would define a social revolution.
What's the difference between that and a political revolution, which we referred to a little bit earlier?
The political revolution changes the form of government or the form of state. In the case of the American Revolution, it was a political revolution because the British crown was no longer the governing authority. There was a new republican form of government. In other words, the superstructure of society is shifted. The political governance of society is shifted. That's what we would call a political revolution, or at least one definition of political revolution. A social revolution is different from a political revolution in that it changes property relations in society. It changes the class and social relations. It turns things upside down. It's not just a change in governance, but a change in class power.
Now, what's the difference between revolution and reform?
Let's just make it specific. When we're fighting, as we do fight every day, for a higher minimum wage, that's a reform within the capitalist system. The capitalist system itself could be made to give the working class, especially the lowest paid workers, a higher wage. If we fight for unionization, or as the workers did in the 1930s, where they were fighting for unemployment insurance or a minimum wage or social security, things that did not exist before 1935, those were reforms, very far-reaching reforms, very important reforms, but reforms that could happen without revolution. In other words, change that could happen as a consequence of a number of different factors, the most important one being the struggle of the people, but it happens within the framework of the existing social system, within the existing power and class relations. Or the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that was a far-reaching reform and one that had been fought for by almost a revolutionary wave of activism throughout the South and the North. And the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that gave the franchise to large segments of Black America, of the African-American community that had been denied the franchise, legally denied the franchise, illegally but legally done in Southern states. The Roe v. Wade, the right of women to have abortion rights, very important, but a reform that could happen within the capitalist system. In fact, it happened during the Nixon administration, a very conservative administration. The reform for marriage equality, or the other reforms that are associated with the struggle of the LGBTQ community for equality and against discrimination. These are all reforms. And obviously, we can say that these reforms have happened inside the context of the capitalist system. Minimum wage didn't used to be. Now we have a minimum wage. It's fallen behind. It hasn't kept up with inflation, but clearly it exists. The right to form unions didn't exist before 1935 when the Wagner Act was passed and signed into law by Roosevelt. Those were all reforms, again, happening within the context of the capitalist system. And furthermore, every time workers in a union fight for a union contract, every time, say, they get a wage increase or an increase in benefits, those are what we would consider reforms within the existing capitalist system. They don't overthrow the relationship of exploitation between workers and bosses, but they alter the formula by which, or the rate of exploitation by which, the bosses make profits, or at a certain level, and the workers make wages at a certain level. Again, reforms within the existing social system.
A couple of examples to query you about. PSO works around issues of a living wage, works around issues of abortion rights. Now, given both of those issues as examples, are essentially fighting for reforms within the current system, does that or does that not, or if it does or if it doesn't, how does it make PSL's position reformist or not?
Well, for us and for Marxists, and this is how Marx and Lenin and other figures considered the teachers of Marxism approach this issue, all of the consciousness that forms, that becomes socialist consciousness or communist consciousness, or what Marx and Lenin called class consciousness or class for itself consciousness. In other words, the consciousness where the working class starts to see itself as a class, not as a particular trade or a particular profession or a particular race or a particular ethnicity or a particular religion or coming from a particular geographic area, but as a class. In other words, the idea that we are exploited because we have to sell our labor every day. And the reason we sell our labor every day is because we don't own property which would allow us to sustain our own lives. And we sell our labor to those who do own property, those who could employ us, those who make profit from our labor. That idea that we are not a profession or a trade, but we are a class of workers, and we are confronted every day in our lives in an antagonistic relationship with those who employ us, in other words, those who own property and who don't have to work as a consequence of their ownership but employ our labor, that consciousness, that class consciousness or socialist consciousness, that comes about in the course of struggle. It doesn't come about from reading books, even though we want people to read books. It doesn't come about through simply having discussion groups. It comes about because of experience, and it comes about in particular as the working class rises out of its routine, its day-to-day kind of conservatizing routine, and engages in struggle. What does it normally struggle about? It struggles about the issues of the day. It struggles about that which is missing in society, about that which has become the latest abuse or outrage in the system. It's a struggle to survive. And those struggles are the struggles for reform. In other words, to make life better. But the difference between the way a revolutionary approaches a struggle for reform and the way a reformist approaches the struggle for reforms is how the struggle is conducted. Reformists in a labor movement would say, to the extent that auto workers, for instance, get a good contract from GM, for instance, they'll say, see, GM and the auto workers have something in common with each other. What's good for GM and what's good for business could, if management has a correct labor policy, and if the union is strong enough, that they can have fairness and justice. And as a consequence, management wins because the workers are happy, and the workers win because they have perhaps a better wage and benefit package in the course of a contract. There's kind of a mutuality of interest. The revolutionist approaches it completely different. The revolutionist says to their co-worker, if we get higher wages or benefits, it's because and only because of the fierceness of our struggle, the resoluteness of our struggle, the steadfastness of our struggle, our ability to enlist community support, our ability to stop production and scare the bosses or deprive the bosses of profit. In other words, it's the power of our mobilization that has brought about a reform or an improvement in our living condition. Tells the workers that it's only the struggle, not a mutuality of interest. In fact, the interests of the bosses and the interests of the union are irreconcilable differences, that they're antagonistic fundamentally, and that it is only the struggle of the workers that provides any reform. And of course, we see this every day because today, even when companies make huge profits, IBM in 1995 made its biggest profit in IBM's history. It made a $5 billion profit, which in 1995 was a big number. And they took that $5 billion in excess profit, profit created by the labor of IBM workers, and then they laid off 25,000 IBM workers and replaced them with new machines and new computers and high-tech equipment. What was good for IBM was not good for the workers. And to the extent that IBM was stronger and had a greater profit margin, it meant, in fact, more of the workers were expendable and could be replaced. It could be made into redundant workers. The revolutionist fights for reforms, but shed of any illusions about mutuality of class interest, and instead preaches the idea that the class interests are fundamentally hostile, that what's good for capital is not what's good for labor. In fact, the only thing that's good for labor and the working class in general is the weakening of capital and the ability of the working class eventually to take control of society itself. In other words, to have a class that has class for itself consciousness that wants to take control and be the masters of society. Fundamentally, the revolutionist says to the worker, we will fight with you and learn through the struggle with you in the struggle for higher wages, but we know that higher wages can be taken back. They can be taken back 3 or 4 years later. The same company could come back and say to us, well, if you don't take a wage cut, we're going to move to Thailand or to Mexico or somewhere else, or move to the southern states if they're northern factories. We also know that our wages, even when we have wage hikes, those wages can be diminished greatly if our landlord raises our rent or if prices go up. In other words, the purchasing power of our wage, even if it's the consequence of an intense labor struggle, an increase in wage, that can all be taken back and is routinely taken back by the mechanisms and workings of the capitalist society. That ultimately the revolutionist goes into the struggle for reform with the idea that the struggle for reform is a school for revolution, but only if part of the message is beyond the simple and solitary reform that we're fighting for the working class to see how society functions in a fundamental way in the course of that struggle.
I want to ask you about the topic of labor unions, or what you were just mentioning a moment ago. Labor unions fight for better wages, better benefits, essentially a reformist agenda. How does a communist operate within the union?
Well, that's a vitally important question because the unions are the biggest expression of organization within the proletariat, within the modern working class. And the unions have formed not just in one country or a few countries, they form in every country, which shows there's a universality to the struggle for unions. They are the first line of defense that the workers form against the ravages of exploitation by the bosses. The bosses have the power to hire and to fire, to lower wages, do whatever. The only power that workers have is through their combined and collective defense action. And that's how unions form. That's how they developed over time in all continents. The union is not fundamentally a revolutionary organization in the sense that what the goal of a union is, its basic mission, is to form a collective of organized workers who can then negotiate with or bargain with the bosses over the rate of exploitation. In other words, exploitation is when the capitalists employ labor and make super profits or abundant profits or surplus value from the labor of workers. The workers get something in the form of wages. That value that they create, which is greater than their wages, is kept by the boss, and that's surplus value or profit. That struggle by the unions is over the rate of exploitation. It's not about exploitation itself. The normal functioning of unions, and this goes even for revolutionaries who are in unions, is how to become the very best organizer to defend the workers in that struggle over the rate of exploitation, recognizing that it's not the full program and it's still about the rate of exploitation, how high or how low wages are or how big or small benefits are. The difference between a reformist union organizer, even a very militant reformist union organizer, and a revolutionary union organizer is not about the nature of the union itself. The union is the union. It is bargaining over the rate of exploitation or organizing to defend the workers in the face of the demands of the bosses. Whether you're a reformist or a revolutionary, there are certain things you have to do. You have to mobilize the workers. You have to organize them. You have to give them a sense of confidence. You have to find the strong workers and facilitate their leadership. You have to reach out to the middle or weaker workers who are maybe confused by the boss's propaganda, and you just have to use basic arguments to win them over against the boss's propaganda. You have to be able to give the workers confidence. And then in the course of negotiations, you have to be able and skilled in terms of how to really negotiate. In other words, whether you're a revolutionary or a reformist, there are certain basic negotiating skills that an organizer needs. The difference is that the revolutionary or communist amongst the workers also brings into their struggle with the workers a broader message that what we really need in society and what we can really achieve in society is not simply to negotiate over the rate of our own exploitation, but we can create a system whereby the workers take control of the means of production, the factories, the mines, the transport, the communication systems. In other words, all that which is now privately owned by the capitalists, we can take control of that. And instead of those resources being used for the enrichment of the capitalist class, they can be used to satisfy the needs of the working class and the needs of society. That's how, by the way, you would get a full employment economy where people would work at a living wage, a real living wage, and have free health care. You'd do away with the capitalist mode of production within the healthcare system. People would go to a doctor and receive healthcare services, not as a source for someone else's profit, but just simply to have that need met because it's a human need. In other words, the communist inside the union fights as a good unionist, but also trying to educate at least the more advanced sector of the working class with the idea that there's no mutuality, no combined mutual interest with the bosses, and also that we can have a different kind of society when the working class takes power.
Now, what's wrong with fighting for that which is readily attainable? I mean, there are things that are reforms which are vital, things like Social Security, the increase of a minimum wage. Those are issues that matter to a lot of people.
And those are the things that revolutionists like the PSL and revolutionary socialists, what's the main thing that we're doing in the day in and day out struggle is to fight on those reforms because they are essential. But as I said, we're not simply fighting to defend Social Security because we recognize that the mechanism of capitalist globalization is driving down the rights of the working class and the rights of retirees, the benefit levels all the time. They're constantly under assault. How do we really guarantee that when you get old, when you reach middle age or 55 or 60, when you no longer should be working full time, how can you have a very wonderful life in the sense that all of the things that you need are taken care of, that you're not risking impoverishment or additional impoverishment? How does it come to be that the working class, which creates all of the vast wealth of society, can actually be guaranteed essential rights rather than simply clawing every year to fight to maintain the meager benefits that one does get on Social Security in the face of continual attacks by the ruling class that essentially wants to do away with Social Security because they want their hands on that money? They want to privatize that system. They want to use that money for their stock exchange, for their own investments. We need to go to a society where there's not any hunger, there's no poverty, and where old people and young people, the very youngest and the very oldest, should never, ever, ever be plagued again with the catastrophe and tragedy of poverty. All of that is possible, but only able to be realized and then secured and made realizable for generations to come by a revolutionary transformation of society.
Brian Becker, what are our takeaways for this episode?
We want the revolutionists to be the best reformists in the sense that they're the fiercest fighters and most able and capable fighters for the reforms that people need every day, but not reformist in the sense that they want to limit the struggle to that which is possibly attainable today but which will be taken back by the capitalists tomorrow. That we want these reforms to be made permanent, to be expanded in a way that human beings, all human beings, are guaranteed that which is possible, a good life, a decent standard of living, a life where the threat of poverty and want has vanished and where people can really realize their full potential as individuals in all realms because they're no longer struggling for survival. right now we can see the general trajectory of capitalism, no matter how hard we fight for reforms, is to lower wages, to diminish wages, to take the workers' wages in the first world, so-called, and drive them down because they're competing with workers in what was known before as the third world, that the globalization of capitalism is such that it's driving the working class into impoverishment all over the place. That's a trend. That's a dominant trend within the capitalist system, and that trend cannot be ameliorated simply fighting over and over and over again to hold on to the reforms that have been achieved in the past. We have to liberate society and its resources from the death grip now of the capitalist class, whose possession of the means of production and possession of that which creates the wealth, their control over that is a death sentence, literally, for millions of people, where you have a third of the population of the world living under $2 a day, and you have 500 or 600 billionaires in the United States who have the equivalent wealth of 70 or 80% of the population, where more and more children are being born into poverty, even though we're fighting so hard for reforms. The real problem we face is the capitalist system itself, and the only remedy for that is, of course, revolution.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. Tune in next week for more from the struggle for justice.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artist. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events and learn more about how you can get involved. PSLweb.org. Again, that's PSLweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.